All right. With no further ado, we'll get Dr. Jensen and be able to give him some time. Good to have you, brother.
Thank you. Thank you, Pastor Mark. Thank you all for coming out. I see some of you from the retreat that I was able to speak to twice over the past couple of days. What I want to speak this morning on is kind of a continuation of that. Of course, if you were not part of that retreat, no problem. There's nothing that you need as a prerequisite to understand this. What I want to do in the few minutes we have together is essentially advance this thesis. I've titled this The Quiet Revolution, How Young Earth Science is Pushing Back Four Decades of Criticism. For this audience, you probably believe whatever I tell you, because I think I have some level of trust here. But in today's culture, if you take this thesis, you say this sentence outside these walls to your neighbors and such, they might laugh in your face or say, you're nuts. What are you talking about, a quiet revolution? So what I want to do, the outline of this talk is essentially word by word, phrase by phrase, justifying this thesis so that by the end of it, you can say, now I see what you're talking about. And so that you may also be able to take this to your neighbors and tell them, oh, wait a minute, there is something radical that's happening in science. There's some major revolutions that are ongoing. Young Earth creation science is doing things no one anticipated. But I'm getting ahead of myself. So let's work through this piece by piece, beginning with the word revolution. Again, I'm thinking of how much you take this to your neighbors. How would you justify this thesis? Why would I talk about a revolution? Number one, because if we're talking about young earth creation science, you might already be familiar with these statistics. The statistics are not in young earth creation science favor currently. 99%, this is from the Pew Forum survey, 99% of scientists would hold to a position that we label evolution. Humans and other living things have evolved over time. And only 1% would give an answer that's typically considered a creationist answer. So there really is no young earth creation community out there, or if there is, it's very minuscule. And so I'm saying, using the word revolution, because to flip the scientific community to something that's much more akin to young earth creation science would be revolutionary. It'd be very much against the mainstream of thought right now. The second reason I use the word revolution is because in today's day and age, many people think that revolutions don't even exist. They can't occur. If there's a consensus of science, there's no questioning it. No one should question it. It's never going to be overturned. And that's very historically illiterate. And I'm going to give you one example that I think is kind of ironic. Darwin himself effected a revolution. What do I mean? I want to walk you through some history real fast here, just some dates, so that you can see what Darwin himself said about what he accomplished. He effected a revolution in his day. The modern scientific consensus is the result of a revolution. So to somehow now say in 2022 revolutions have stopped is to miss all this history. So Darwin publishes his book, November 1859. The first edition says in the closing chapter where Darwin anticipates that people are going to object to what he says and he gives some responses. This is one of the key sentences, and I've broken this up this way so you can see how the sentence changes with time. So Darwin says at that time, 1859, first edition, he says, why, this is a rhetorical question, why, it may be asked, have all the most eminent living naturalists and geologists rejected this view of the mutability or the change of species? So he's arguing against a view that species are unchanged, fixed, have always been the way they are now since the beginning dawn of creation. He's saying they've evolved, they've changed. So he's saying, he's admitting, look, I know that pretty much everyone out there is going to reject what I just said. So then he tries to give four reasons why he thinks it's time for them to change their view. What's remarkable to me is that the 1869 edition, so this is the fifth edition now, that sentence changes one decade later. And you can verify this all for yourself. Darwin's works are all now freely available online. It's like, I forget the exact website, but if you just Google it, you'll be able to find it. You can find all this text here. You can compare it side by side. There's lots of tools out there. This sentence in a decade later doesn't read this way. Darwin instead says, why, it may be asked, until recently did nearly all the most eminent living naturalists and geologists reject this view. So in one decade, he flipped the consensus to his favor. So again, in these four walls, I don't think I need to say this. You go outside these walls and somehow people have to be convinced again, yes, scientific revolutions are normal. They've happened all throughout scientific history. In fact, the modern consensus is the result of a scientific revolution. So if people want to reject the concept that revolutions can take place, if they want to reject the concept that you can question things, you have to ask them, why do they believe what we believe today? And the only answer they can give in a historically informed way is, well, because someone questioned the consensus of that day. So that's the first word then of this thesis, quiet revolution. Revolutions have occurred, and I'm arguing, what I'm trying to set up then is it would be normal for another revolution to occur. After the colon there, I say how young earth creation science is pushing back against four decades of criticism. So let's take a look at that. What has this criticism looked like? I was born 1980, so a lot of what I'm showing you is in a sense near and dear to my heart because it covers my lifespan, what creationists have been up against. And I don't pick the last four decades simply because of my birth year, but because, I wouldn't have time to get into this. If you look at the history of creation science from the publication of The Genesis Flood by Whitcomb and Morris to the foundation of the Institute for Creation Research, if you're not familiar with it, just some major events in the modern resurgence of young earth creation science, 1980, the transition from the 70s to 80s is a watershed moment. 1970s is when there were lots of debates in universities where the evolutionists themselves said they were unprepared for what the creation scientists were saying, and they regroup in the early 1980s around the same time as when the National Center for Science Education is founded, which is basically the National Center for Evolution Advancement, climate change, that sort of thing, political ends. This is a key point in time when things change. So I want to read you several quotes here. The point is not that you walk away and have these memorized, but there's a theme here I want you to see over several decades, because I'll give you some from the 80s, then something more close to the present, 80s, 90s, yeah, and then something in the 2000s, that show that the general attitude that's been out there. So this is to give you the feel of what's going on, then I'll give you the specifics of how this has coalesced in court decisions and such, and if you were to go off to college, or if you're in college, what you're going to hear in the classroom. Or if you're arguing with an atheist, and they go to one of the favorite atheist sites, this is what they're going to say. And you probably already have a sense for this first general point. So here's some quotes. This is from an 82 court decision. So again, the 80s, I'm marking off here because this is during the 80s is when some of the major decisions were made in the legal system as to whether or not you could or could not teach creation science in the public school system. So this judge overruled a law that was on the books in Arkansas. This is McLean versus the Arkansas Board of Education. Arkansas had enacted a law saying you did have to teach creation science. The judge says, no, you can't do that. Why? Well, he says the creationists' methods do not take data, weigh it against the opposing scientific data, and thereafter reach the conclusions. While anybody is free to approach a scientific inquiry in any fashion they choose, they cannot properly describe the methodology used as scientific if they start with a conclusion and refuse to change it regardless of the evidence developed during the course of the investigation. So you may have heard this attitude as, well, what we're really talking about is religion versus science. And religion has these conclusions and you just kind of fit facts to it. Basically the attitude that religion holds no truth whatsoever. People just come up with these ideas and then they try to find evidence in the world to support it, even though there's nothing in the world really to support it. Whereas science is this thing where you question the world and you build up a body of knowledge and nothing is sacred. That's kind of the idea. Another quote then, just to again show you there's a general pattern. This has been consistent for decades now. This is the type of criticism that's out there and still exists. 1995, a prominent evolutionary professor, a quote from one of his textbooks here in a moment, he wrote a book called Science on Trial, A Case for Evolution, arguing against creation science and for evolution. What does he say? He says the creationists are assaulting the entire mode of scientific thought and the guiding principle of science, that traditional beliefs are open to skeptical inquiry. The fact is, in a scientific sense, there can be no evidence for supernatural special creation. Belief in special creation must rest on faith, which again they make almost synonymous with irrationality. There's nothing to support it. And the authority of the Bible and its most literal interpreters, so it's a special scorn there for young earth creationists. The fundamental conflict then is between two incompatible ways to knowledge. So if you're at the retreat, we talked about the idea in the culture being that there's a conflict between science and faith. These guys actually go beyond that and say faith is actually opposed to science. It's anti-science. You're a Christian. I'm going to immediately view you with skepticism because the nature of your worldview is opposed to the process of science. That's what he's saying. Science emphasizes evidence and logical deduction is forever uncertain. It deals not with irrefutable facts engraved on stone tablets, but with hypotheses that may be refuted by tomorrow's experiments and concepts formulated by fallible human minds. The best scientific education encourages skepticism, questioning, independent thought, and the use of reason. So again, there's that same sentiment of religion. Christianity, as a specific example of religion, is opposed to science itself, not just the consensus, but the process of doing science, because there's so much certainty. I work for Answers in Genesis, so even that name, Answers in Genesis, oh, it's so anti-scientific because you're giving answers. We should be asking questions. That's the idea. So fast forward now, last quote I'm going to give you from his, he now has a co-author, Mark Kirkpatrick. They together have published, had been publishing multiple editions of an evolutionary textbook. So if you go off to college, you're in college and you major in some sort of life sciences or biology, in the secular school system, you'll likely have to take a evolution course as a, in your junior year. And you might even use this textbook. The closing chapter of this book has a whole section, actually the whole closing chapter is how to deal with creation science, which, by the way, in a sense, marks progress. If you go back to the 1950s, you don't see these chapters because there just was no organized creationist opposition. Now, they recognize there's creationist opposition. Yes, the statistics are still 99% evolutionist, but they recognize there is this strong push that they now have to address, which they didn't have to address 50 years ago. So here's a quote from that closing chapter dealing with creation science. Futuma and Kirkpatrick say, "Indeed, much of science consists of seeking chinks in the armor of established ideas. Thus, science as a social process is tentative. It questions belief and authority. It continually tests its views against evidence. Science differs in this way from creationism, which does not use evidence to test its claims, does not allow evidence to shake its a priori commitment to certain beliefs, and does not grow in its capacity to explain the natural world." So, first bullet point then under what I mean by for decades of criticism. This general view is that creationism is religious, it's dogmatic, you can't teach it in science classroom because it's anti-science. It actually goes against the process of doing science, not just evolution, not just whatever favorite political view is out there these days in the scientific community, not just the consensus, but the process of doing science itself. That's been the general attitude. Now, the specific technical manifestation of this, I want to bring up just because it'll be relevant here in a moment, to show how creation science is pushing back against this. What they've taken as the specific technical manifestation of this is as follows. Again, several quotes to show you they're all basically saying the same thing. From that 1982 court decision again, the judge said the essential characteristics of science are, he listed five of them. I want to highlight this last one here, the idea that science is falsifiable. He, of course, says creation science fails to meet these essential characteristics. So therefore, you can't teach it in the science classroom. What is falsifiability? So I have up here a water bottle. Gravity is what the scientific community would say is a scientific idea because you can, in theory, falsify it, disprove it. I've got my grip on this water bottle. If I release my grip, gravity predicts, you know, future from what I'm saying right now in real time, that it'll fall to the earth. If I release my grip and this bottle starts levitating towards the ceiling, then we'd have reason to start questioning gravity. Of course, I release my grip, the bottle falls, gravity is still valid. I could test it again. We could wake up tomorrow and do the same type of experiment, simple lay-level experiment, but that's the idea. Give us something we can test. Or, just to give you an example right now, thinking about the origin of species. The evolutionary community would say, some of whom have actually read creation science, many have not, they would say, okay, we recognize now that modern creation science holds to this concept of kinds, that God creates kinds, Genesis chapter 1, not species. Noah takes kinds on board the ark, not species. So from the kinds taken on board the ark, new species have formed after the flood. So the lion, the tiger, the house cat all belong to the same kind. Noah takes two cat-like creatures on board the ark. Those come off the ark, reproduce, and form the various species of lions, tigers, ocelots, house cats, so forth. So they would say, fine, that's your premise. Give us something we can test. Tell us, creation scientists, how many new species of cats are going to form this year? or in the next 100 years, or the next 1,000 years. Give us something we can go out into the field or into the lab and do an experiment to see if you're wrong. That's the idea. That's what they're looking for. Another quote from a famous paleontologist, Niles Eldridge. You may have heard the name Stephen Jay Gould. Niles Eldridge he worked with Stephen Jay Gould on this idea of punctuated equilibrium. If that's familiar to you, great. If not, that's fine too. He wrote a book in 1982 called The Monkey Business, A Scientist Looks at Creationism. And of course, he spared no vocabulary to express his feelings about creation science. So he says creation science isn't science at all, nor have creation scientists managed to come up with even a single intellectually compelling, scientifically testable statement about the natural world. So testable, falsifiable, basically the same idea. Again, I can test gravity. I can, in theory, disprove gravity. I haven't. So that's why it's still held as a valid concept. And then fast forward again to the same textbook I referenced earlier. They again cite this concept, Fatuma and Kirkpatrick, saying the most important feature of scientific hypotheses is that they are testable. So again, the big umbrella overarching principle is that religion, Christianity, creation science is opposed to science itself, because science questions things, and then the specific manifestation of how you question things is by doing experiments, by being able to test things, to falsify things. That's the technical manifestation, not that well known among the general public, but this is what you'll find on websites. Again, you'll see it in the textbooks. This is what they fall back on in the courtroom, and when you really start pressing them. If you were to even give them anti-evolutionary arguments, at some point they might concede, okay, sure, there's things evolution doesn't answer, but that's no justification for then letting creation science in the door, because that's anti-science. Can't do that. Last point then that I want to show you here, which I don't think I need to justify to you, but yes, okay. I forgot for a minute where I was going with this. Last thing I want to show you in terms of what this criticism has manifested itself as, just look at the pervasive effects this type of thinking has had. It's affected, it's excluded, based on that court decision I showed you, and also a 1987 Supreme Court decision. It's basically excluded creation science from instruction, which is the primary thing that happens scientifically in K-12 and early undergraduate. Once you're in a science, so I guess where I'm going with this is, what I want to show you is that every step of the scientific development and professional career process is captured by evolutionary thinking, by anti-creationist thinking. You can't teach creation science in the schools. If you write for grants, you can't get funding for it. If you try to publish creation science, it'll never get accepted. Using myself as a specific illustration, the only way you can succeed essentially as a creation scientist is to avoid all that. So I was homeschooled through 8th grade. And went to a small Christian high school that was explicitly young earth. My parents picked it for that purpose. So avoided the evolutionary instruction, though going to young earth conferences, I heard plenty of evolution and could recapitulate in class. When I did my graduate work at Harvard on, well, in this case, I was working on adult stem cell research. The point I'm trying to make here is I didn't work on evolution questions, origin questions, creation science questions. We got lots of funding. My boss wrote for $1 million grants. For medical research, I was able to get through as a creation scientist by not doing creation science, in a sense. And then, of course, now that I am a professional creation scientist, I've been doing it for 13 years or so, when I publish, I can't publish any of the mainstream journals. We have to publish it in our own private peer-reviewed journals. Why is that the way things are? It goes back to this concept. You can't teach it. You can't get funding for it. You can't publish it because they'd all say creation science is not testable. It's not scientific. And this resistance to creation science has had massive success in today's culture, successfully marginalized creation science, pushed it completely out of the mainstream and on the fringes. So that's a tall amount of criticism to push back against. So I said my thesis here is that there's a quiet revolution taking place. Young Earth creation science is pushing back against this. Let's focus on that now. How has creation science pushed back against this? Creationism is anti-scientific. Creationism does not make testable predictions. So I'm gonna very quickly walk you through some of the history of my own work, just because that's the work I'm familiar with. But we could give examples from geology and astronomy. I'm going to give from biology and genetics because that's the work I do. And we're recording this, yes, Lachlan? We're recording this, so And I think I can put the slides up there as well afterwards, so don't feel like you have to write all this down or remember all this. We'll have it up there for recording and viewing later. This is just to give you a very brief sketch of what's happened just in the last decade or so, and then set up for you how evolutionists have responded to this, because that's really where the rubber meets the road and it gets explosive. Okay, 2017, I published a book called Replacing Darwin. Again, I'm using the first person pronoun because I'm telling my story, because this is the one I know best, not because this is the best example of it per se. My colleagues have done work in geology, astronomy, and that parallels what I'm showing you here. I've sort of built on their foundation. So this isn't to exalt me or anything. Just to give you an example of how creation science as a whole is pushing back against this creationism and anti-science idea. The title of the book was Replacing Darwin, and I picked that deliberately, not rebutting Darwin, rejecting Darwin, but replacing Darwin, because I was aware of the standard that's been set by the evolutionary community for creation science. And by the way, I'll just tell you where I'm going. I would, of course, disagree that creation science is anti-science, but I would say this, for the evolutionary community to insist on creation scientists making testable predictions, that's just a general rule for science. So why would I, in a sense, concede their point? I would concede their point and also not concede their point. Should science be defined by testable predictions? Yes. What the evolutionists want to say is, we can find examples where creation science hasn't done that, therefore we should throw out the entire thing. What I'm going to show you is, that is the standard, and the challenge for the evolutionary community is, creation science has matured. Creation science has matured and is making and has made testable predictions. And here's the examples then. So creation science has pushed back against that criticism. And of course, where I'm going with this is, if the evolutionists are indeed consistent, they've been insisting on the standard for 40 years, they should logically recognize now that creation science is science and has been science for quite some time. I'm going to show you some responses to what I've done that I think are really eye-opening. But let me tell you the backstory first. Here's the backstory. Published a book, Replacing Darwin, in which I put testable predictions in print. The focus of this book is the origin of species in general, with some focus on the origin of humans, because we're one of millions of species on the globe. One of the things I put in print in this book was a specific prediction about the history of humanity. I'm going to give you the quote here, it's a mouthful of a one that's kind of technical, but I'll summarize it for you just so you get the concept. And this isn't something that's somehow unique to me. I had this great insight. Almost anyone can derive this type of prediction. The prediction is, if we take the biblical anthropology at face value, which says that God creates Adam and Eve, two people, only two people, not a population, two people 6,000 years ago, approximately 6,000 years ago. Perfect, Genesis chapter 1 and 2. Chapter 3, they sin, and all the descendants now are sinners. But they obey the command to be fruitful and multiply. They do, but the whole world goes corrupt. God decides to destroy the entire planet, except for Noah, his wife, his sons, and their wives, eight people in total. God wipes the face of the earth clean, except for those survivors on board the ark and the animals with them. And so humanity restarts with eight people about 4,500 years ago after the flood. Another consequence of this biblical anthropology is that God wipes clean all the pre-flood civilizations, because it's a global flood, destroys the world. And so when we talk about the history of civilization, Egypt and its list of dynasties, Sumer and Assyria and Babylon and Greece and Rome and everything else, all that is post-flood history. So post-flood history really is the history of civilization. So if that's true, we should be able to see the signature of this in our DNA. And by the way, you'd expect something different from evolution, because the evolution says humanity evolved in Africa 200,000 years ago, and almost all of that history transpires until 5,000 years ago, civilization begins, Egypt and Sumer. And so they would say the history of civilization is just a tiny fraction of the history of humanity. Young Earth creationists say the history of civilization is the history of humanity. It's the big chunk. So they would almost not even look for the genetic echoes of the history of civilization. Young Earth creationists are primed to do so. That's what they would expect. That's what they predict. It's a testable prediction. And just to give you an example of what this might look like, you've probably heard of Genghis Khan's empire, the greatest land-based empire the world has ever seen, from the Pacific all the way into Eastern Europe. So about the 1200s, you'd expect then Mongolian DNA, genetics, genes, to become part of the European gene pool. And there's ways, technical ways, you can go about looking for this. That's just one example. The bigger point being, though, we should be able to see the history of civilization, Rome, Greece, boom, boom, all these other civilizations in our DNA in a manner consistent with the Young Earth YEC, Young Earth Creation Model. And I specifically said that the Y chromosome differences, the male inherited DNA differences, should represent one of these signatures. The bigger point here, again, if you don't get lost in the technicalities, the bigger point is 2017, I make a prediction, one for which I did not yet know the answer, that we could then, in the subsequent years, we're now 2022, evaluate. Mark kindly left me this book. And what I'm going to, just to cut to the chase, this book represents a fulfillment of those predictions. Things we've discovered in the last few years I didn't even anticipate. I want to now sketch for you very quickly, again, we're going to race through a lot of stuff that may sound somewhat technical, and my point is not that you follow every single detail. What I want to show you, though, is that there's been a progression of predictions, fulfillments. Predictions, fulfillments. There's been science that's been done over the last 5 years. And then I want to show you how the evolutionary community has responded. So this book came out in March, and there's already been three evolutionary biology PhDs, which I'll show you them in a few minutes, that have responded to this book. And I want you to see how they've responded to this progress of predictions, fulfillments, predictions, fulfillments. So now, very briefly, just some background to what I'm talking about, and just to show you what's happened, what's been published, what's been discovered in this realm of human genetics, human history. And then the specific tool I'm using here is the Y chromosome of the male inherited DNA. It's just a fraction of the male's total DNA, about 1%. Fathers pass it on to their sons, but it just so happens to be a useful tool for technical reasons that we could talk about a different time. Because we live in a fallen world, I say that theologically, empirically, for whatever reason, we know that when father's sperm stem cells, the cells that produce sperm, copy the Y chromosome, copy DNA, they make mistakes. There's mistakes that occur. The DNA is not copied perfectly. So a father sires a son, and the son does not have an exact replica of dad's DNA. There's errors that occur. And just as a side note, when I entered graduate school and was working on medical research, I was rather skeptical of genetics playing a role in disease, except in rare cases like sickle cell anemia and such. It just seemed all too convenient that everyone would keep invoking genetics to explain disease, to explain cancer, to explain heart disease, to explain whatever you want. To me, it was synonymous with, we don't have a better explanation, so we're going to say genetics is what explains it, as if we couldn't come up with anything better. I've now sort of reversed course in light of some of the research I've done, and now I'm beginning to warm up to the idea that maybe we're now at a genetic threshold. Enough generations have transpired since creation, since the fall, that maybe our DNA is just kind of unraveling, in a sense, with mistakes, and so diseases are exploding. I don't know the full answer yet, but that's just a side note to say this is a error-prone process, and we're beginning to see more and more manifestations of the detrimental effects it has on human health. Some of them you don't see, some of them you do. The point is there are mistakes that are made. I call them mistakes because we can see real examples of DNA in dad was this, DNA in child is this, or DNA in parent is this, child is this, and now child is this disease, parent didn't have it, and away we go. Okay. In the evolutionary literature, these aren't experiments I did. This is experiments evolutionists did, mainstream community did. They took DNA from fathers, took DNA from sons, and they measured, well, they counted the number of differences between the two. The earliest studies that attempted to do so go back to 2009. There was one study of two Chinese men who had a common ancestor in the 1800s. So they got the DNA of both men. They compared them. They counted the number of differences. Said, okay, this many generations back to this common ancestor. This is how many mistakes, DNA copying errors, occur per generation. And it was rather slow. It seemed to fit evolution. I started as a professional creation scientist in 2009. I was working on a different type of DNA. I was aware of this study, and I thought, okay, I don't know what to make of it. It's one study. It's a small sample size. Maybe things will change as more is published. And lo and behold, this is how things turned out. By 2017, which is when I really was starting to get into this Y chromosome more heavily. There were four published studies of which I was aware. I've used a technical term here that two were high coverage, two were low coverage. That's just a technical term for two were high quality, two for low quality. And to make a long story short, the high quality studies that looked at dad's DNA, son's DNA, found lots of differences. And the low quality studies that compared dad's DNA to son's DNA found few differences. This was consistent with young earth creation science. This is consistent with evolution. And what I argued in the paper I published in 2019 was this supports the young earth creation timescale. The best data that we have supports the young earth creation timescale. Now, this is a table from, I have a pen here. I said the wrong thing. Anyway, I won't try to mess with this pen because I don't know what I'm doing. I'm just a scientist, that's right. There's four papers here. Oh, I know what I need to do. Laser pointer. There we go. So these are the names of the papers. You can look them up. Again, we'll put the slides up online if you're curious about the nerdy stuff. But I want to point you to one example here. So this data all comes from the evolutionists themselves. They've published this. I'm simply taking what they've done, oftentimes taking the raw data and saying, hey, look, this is what it seems to imply. What I'm driving at is that the evolutionists were aware of the high-quality studies giving fast rates of change that were inconsistent with evolution. I don't know that anyone bothered to try to calculate if it was consistent with creation science. So what did they do? And truth is stranger than fiction. They literally filtered out data that didn't match. So these studies, this guy in particular, here we go, yeah. This guy in particular, here's a quote from the supplemental data. Actually, let me clarify something here. If you read the main text of this paper that I've boxed here, the main text of the paper will say, we found a rate of change that fit their expectations. You have to dig into the supplemental data where they talk about the nitty-gritty details. So here's a quote from that supplemental data from the paper. They say, so FS here, father-son differences, you can see that up here. So they say here, I've underlined, the number of father-son differences, dad's DNA versus son's DNA, was approximately tenfold higher than the expected number of mutations, changes, considering the range of published Y chromosome mutation rates. And they're citing here in support of, hey, this is too high, the low quality study here, that's the Chinese men, and then there's some other ones here that deal with fossil DNA and such. And they say here, this finding prompted us to explore additional filters. And if you're, again, really curious, you can look up the paper yourself and see all that they say. So that was an initial finding as I was digging into the Y chromosome mutation rate. This is 2019 after the published predictions in 2017. So this is the main thing I'm trying to communicate. There's a timeline, and the timeline is critical. If you're talking about predictions, are there things put in print that future experiments could reveal to be true or false? Is there some uncertainty? That's what they're looking for. So I put some uncertainty in print, and now we're evaluating it. Okay, so there's mistakes. One of the questions, of course, that arises, we could spend a long time discussing the details, I'll just have to summarize it for sake of time. If you measure father and son DNA differences, great, you have one time point in a sense. You've made a measurement in the present. How do you know anything about the past? I said it's consistent with the young earth time scale, but I've made an assumption. I've assumed that today's rates of change have been consistent in the sense I've used the evolutionary assumptions. But hey, why not question it, right? Everything is supposed to be questioned in science. How do we know that what we've measured in the present has been consistent in the past? Long story short, there's a way to do that using population growth curves, which I don't want to get into the technical details of right now. I just want you to know that I tested that hypothesis and found that this assumption I made was in fact valid by independent lines of evidence. That was a companion paper, 2019. 2017, again, is Replacing Darwin, the book where I make predictions about seeing the signatures of human history. 2019, there are two papers saying, whoa, it looks like we're seeing things that are consistent with it. And I'm just going to skip through this for sake of time. Those data, I do want to say this, though. So we made predictions about, in general, about human history in our DNA in 2017. We find some initial results 2019 that seem consistent with it. Father-son differences, there seemed to be a lot of them, consistent with what you'd expect with humanity going back to Noah 4,500 years ago. And I tested the assumption that I made directly with data that evolutionists would agree on. Fine, so far so good. Those data that I tested with were global in scope. global population curves. My point is, this made additional predictions. It's not like we stopped there and said, good, we found enough that we needed to justify our own predetermined conclusions. It's, hey, this implies something else to test. Regional population growth curves. 2020, again, moving forward in time, tested the regional population history in the Americas. If you were at the retreat, we spent an hour on this, especially the last 20 minutes or so focusing on this. Going forward in time even more, though, and one of the things that shows up in this book is data for North Africa. And none of the studies that I had access to prior to that time, were there any North African data? We know from archaeology and historical records, we can estimate what the population history of North Africa, in this case Algeria, looked like. I say Algeria because the population from North Africa that I then had access to later was a group of Mozabites from Algeria. And again, I'm zipping through the technical details here just so you can see the trajectory. I found a match there as well. So predictions 2017, initial fulfillments in 2019, makes more predictions. Fulfillments in 2020, 2022, good, fine. This makes even more predictions. Here's really the summary slide that I want you to see. Not that you walk away with all the technical details, but simply that you can see there is a pattern here. Predictions, fulfillments. And of course, this book makes even more predictions. There's still more credibility that's on the line. Things I don't know the answer to yet that we're going to keep exploring. And this is the concept the evolutionists do not seem to have grasped. There's been predictions about the father-son rates of change that predicted, we could test whether or not I could extrapolate that back in time at a global scale, then that predicts things at a regional scale. Really the thrust of this book, though, is not population growth curves. It's can we see human history in our DNA? And that's essentially the main thesis of this book. Yes, we can. This, of course, leads to even more predictions. Here's something you can verify for yourself. If you look at the published papers, 2019, I didn't know where Noah was in the tree. I had empirical data to say, well, here we've got a genetic-based tree for humanity, and Noah's somewhere kind of in here, I think. And it wasn't until later, shortly before this book was published, I actually drafted an early version of this book where I didn't know where Noah was, and then through a series of providential events, was able to find the echo of Noah at the base of the tree. And again, if you're at the retreat, we talk about this in detail. The bigger point, though, is this book is simply the beginning, not the end of the story. And I've got a lot of research going forward. 99% of the world's men do not yet have a genetic test. All that's data that could empirically verify or falsify the theses I've advanced. So, again, my point is not that you follow every single technical detail. Instead, what I want you to see, and I've got some videos, by the way, that we've been releasing on the Answers in Genesis YouTube page. If you go to, here it is, Traced, Human DNA's Big Surprise, or if you just go to the AIG YouTube homepage and click on the playlist channel, this should come up. Some of these latest videos, I'm walking through more of this backstory in greater detail and more slowly. What I want you to walk away with is that the critics of creation science have cast creation science as anti-scientific and specifically lacking testable predictions. And what I wanted to show you just briefly here is that creation scientists have published testable predictions, which that itself should be good enough, right? Credibility is on the line. That's what they've demanded. But it's even better than that. Creation scientists have seen it fulfilled, which has led to more predictions, which have seen more fulfilled, which has led to more predictions. And the whole reason I'm still pursuing this research is because it's still working. I have ample reason to stop this every day as soon as we find a contrary result, but it keeps working, which is why I keep chasing it. I gave you sort of a timeline just for the last 5 years in the video series I'm showing. This is really a consistent pattern for over a decade. Okay. Now, I'm just about out of time, so let me make sure I get to the good stuff before we quit. Okay, so why would I call this the quiet revolution? Let me step back for a moment and point out something that I think is implicit in what I've just said, but want to put it explicitly so that we're all on the same page. I said that demanding testable predictions is reasonable. That's a reasonable standard for science. Yes, science is based on certainty. This is just how the process works. There's a lot of philosophy behind it I won't get into. But that also means it's kind of dangerous because when you put a prediction in print, you're basically saying to all your critics, here, come try to disprove me. Come prove me wrong. Come make a fool of me. That's really what scientists do. Here's some rope, now try to hang me. So you would think then, the evolutionist would be delighted to take creation scientists, just again using myself as an example, up on their proposals and go ahead and run wild with doing experiments and disproving creation scientists. So how have the evolutionists responded? This is where it gets, again, another truth is stranger than fiction. Here's the guys, the main guys in terms of PhDs who've been responding. They're all biologists. I'm going to focus, again, just for sake of time, on the guy on the left there, Daniel Cardinale, who's a professor at Rutgers. He's got a video out there. I'm going to use him because he has one of the longer responses, but there's general consistency across all three of these guys. And we'll eventually have a video that addresses all three of them in this video series. If you want the references to their videos or published critiques, I'm happy to supply them. Or I could put them in the notes afterwards too. Cardinale in his video, so here it is traced, there's the title of his video, book review traced by Dr. Daniel Jensen. So this is Dr. Dan. There's about 6 points he makes in criticism. About three of them all kind of say the same thing. And he says that my book is wrong because I've conflated genealogy and phylogeny. I've taken a measurement in the present and erroneously extrapolated back in the past. Now you might say, well, I thought you tested that hypothesis. Yes, he doesn't seem to be aware of the paper, but here's the bigger point. Why does he say what I just did is wrong? Again, he doesn't address the data. He says it's wrong because the textbook says so. One of his complaints, of course, you can't extrapolate back in the past, is because the textbook says so. So here's you can see right here in the slide, the big problem. So it's by his own admission, this is the big problem with my work. But he repeats that same sort of thing specifically elsewhere, overlaying phylogeny and pedigree. There's another point, which is saying the same thing. If you follow his video in context, here's a quote from him. You just can't do that. That's his point. So that's the big explosive part. And again, the other guys are almost saying the same thing. There's other errors that they make. They don't even seem to be aware of some of the work that's published. They make some very basic errors. But this is, to me, the biggest point, because apparently, again, you can't make this up. There are things you can't question in science. There are books that they have that are apparently sacred that you can't question. So my question to them is, which group of people now is the one, which group of scientists, creation scientists or mainstream scientists, are the ones who do not take data, weigh it against opposing scientific data, and thereafter reach the conclusions? Sure, anyone can do it any way they want to, but which group is the one that starts with a conclusion and refuses to change it regardless of the evidence developed during the course of the investigation? Which of these groups has the belief that traditional beliefs are open to skeptical inquiry? Which of these groups is insisting on the authority of a certain book and its most literal interpreters? Which of these groups insists on evidence and logical deduction is forever uncertain? Which of these groups is insisting that there's certain facts and prints you can't differ with? So I guess my point is, he's citing the textbook saying you can't do it. These are the methods I should have used. And my response then would be, well, what's your evidence for that? I've differed. I would openly admit I've differed from these textbook methods, but I supported it then with these line of experiments. So why can't I do that? Can we not question the textbook anymore? That's the idea. Which group of people is the one encouraging skepticism, questioning, independent thought, use of reason? And this is, I feel like, the most relevant quote here. Which of these groups seeks chinks in the armor of established ideas? Apparently you can't question the textbook. So this is what I wanted to get to. So to reiterate, creation science now has, this is going back to that main sentence that I want to justify, creation science is pushing back by publishing testable predictions, seeing them fulfilled, and continuing to do testable predictions. And it's the evolutionists now, which again, this is in a sense to me a gift from the evolutionary community. They're responding in a religious manner. And I say religious by their own standards. They've set up the standards for what's religion. They spent 4 decades saying, here's religion, it's anti-scientific. And then when given the chance to respond directly to the published predictions of creation science, they're acting in a religious manner. Now, why would they do that? I think you can speculate and reach some pretty definite conclusions. For them to take me up on my predictions or take creation science up on its predictions would be to concede the main point. You would be conceding that creation science is now scientific, and you can't do that if you want to maintain a monopoly on education and funding and publication. Okay. I think it illustrates, end with a scripture quote here, the literal text of scripture when Romans 1 says, and actually I'm going to skip ahead of here a verse that says, and then come back to it. The Bible says, since the creation of the world, God's invisible attributes are clearly seen. So scientists of all people who study the natural world have the evidence of God in front of them day in and day out, and they've got to do something with it. More so than people in other occupations. And scripture says they all know God exists, especially scientists, but they suppress the truth. So what better description of, I see what you've done there, and I'm going to act religiously and not allow anything else to shake my beliefs. Suppressing the truth. Not only does evolution directly attack scripture, but the means by which the evolutionists are now responding to creation science is a literal fulfillment of this. I don't know if we have any more books for sale. We got a few at a special price that's even cheaper than what I pay for it. Still at the special price. $6.88 or something. Something like that. Okay, $7 or less. I don't have any of these with me, but now you have some context for it. This is sort of the Cliff Notes version of that. You can find me on social media. I'll put this all up on the website. You don't have to write this all down now if you want to find me. Hopefully you've seen now justification for there is a quiet revolution that's going on. Young Earth creation science is pushing back against 4 decades of criticism. This is a new era in creation science that I don't think the evolutionary community is prepared for, and I'm anxious to see where it goes. I'll be around. I didn't plan on doing Q&A afterwards just because I figured we'd go right to time, but I plan on staying through lunch and such. So as long as people have questions, we can address them then, and then I'll have ways to contact me up on the website as well. Thank you.